Brothers and sisters, if you don't change your ways, you are on the road to Jam Nation.
Editorial note, this episode was originally published to Spotify
on March 12, 2023,
and has now since been re-edited to replace full songs with song clips in order to publish this on other streaming services beyond Spotify. There may be references in this episode to events and dates that well precede the episode publish date on any podcasting platforms that are not Spotify. And there may be references to songs which have since been replaced by song clips. I just don't want anybody to be confused. Now, let's move on to the episode. Enjoy! Welcome back, everybody, to episode 16 of Road to Jam Nation. In this latest episode, I'm going to continue my discussion of this year's nominees for this year's induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I began this discussion during the second half of episode 15 last week. So if you missed that episode, I suggest that you go back and listen to the start of this discussion that's in that episode. Also, that episode starts out with the second half of an interview that started in episode 14. So if you're interested in that interview and haven't heard it yet, then episode 14 may be where you want to start. And in episode 14, I do also spend time discussing the background of the origins of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and its historical charter that it uses for inducting artists into the hall. So as a reminder, there are 14 nominees for this year's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremonies. And those 14 nominees are Cyndi Lauper, George Michael, Sheryl Crow, Willie Nelson, Warren Zevon, Missy Elliott, Joy Division and New Order, who are being nominated jointly, The White Stripes, A Tribe Called Quest, Iron Maiden, Soundgarden, Kate Bush, The Spinners, and Rage Against the Machine. I began my discussions of these nominees last week, trying to go in roughly chronological order based on how long the acts have been eligible for induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So last week, I discussed the nominations of The Spinners, Willie Nelson, and Warren Zevon. And I will continue this week now with the 11 other nominees. I started this week's episode off by playing a song from Joy Division, and as noted, Joy Division is being jointly nominated this year, along with New Order, with New Order being the band that evolved out of Joy Division after the death of their lead singer, lyricist, and leader, Ian Curtis. While there is significant crossover between these two bands, with all three of the surviving members of Joy Division having formed New Order, and then bringing in a new fourth member for that band in Jillian Gilbert, there's no doubt that the musical paths of the two bands and the musical legacy of the two bands are a bit unique, but there is historical precedence for this kind of unified nomination. The Small Faces and the Faces went into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame collaboratively as a single Rock Hall induction. And a bit similar to Joy Division, the Faces were a band that evolved out of the Small Faces. But in that case, there was significant turnover in the band members. The Faces were a much more blues-heavy rock band than the Small Faces had been. And yet the Rock Hall felt that it was the best thing to do to put the two bands in collaboratively. And then when the Hall of Fame inducted George Clinton's outfits, Parliament and Funkadelic, they put them in together as well as Parliament Funkadelic. There had long been speculation in the Rock Hall watcher community that when it came to Joy Division and New Order, that they very well might merit this kind of unified approach. And indeed, that is the path that the Rock Hall chose to take. Joy Division has been eligible for induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame since 2004. If they were considered separately, New Order has been eligible since 2007. This is the first nomination for this band in either one of those incarnations. The members of Joy Division are Ian Curtis, Bernard Sumner, Peter Hook, and Stephen Morris. And then the membership of New Order has been Bernard Sumner, Peter Hook, Stephen Morris, and Jillian Gilbert. Not being nominated for the Rock Hall of Fame is bass player Tom Chapman, who took over the bass slot in 2011 when New Order reformed without Peter Hook. Tom Chapman appears on the band's 2015 album. Also not nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is keyboard player Phil Cunningham, who filled in on keyboards in New Order for Jillian Gilbert from 2001 to 2007 while she was concentrating on raising her family. And Cunningham has continued to be a member of the band since Jillian Gilbert returned. Joy Division only wound up releasing two albums during their existence, but both of those albums were hugely influential, innovative, and excellent. It's probably harder to find alternative bands of the 1980s and 90s who don't count Joy Division as an influence than it is to cite the ones that absolutely are influenced by Joy Division. Joy Division was formed in 1976 as part of the English punk rock explosion, but their sound quickly evolved away from the sort of chaotic noise that was being favored in that scene. Joy Division preferred a more moody and almost claustrophobic sound, full of melancholy. Their music was very stark and minimalist. The band's lead singer, Ian Curtis, had epilepsy, and as the band began to achieve success, their touring demands led to lack of sleep and long hours on the road, which added to the stress that tended to trigger Curtis's seizures. During the tour for the band's second album, he began having seizures frequently while performing on stage. But given the fact that Ian Curtis already favored a fairly jerky and awkward performing style, many people in the audience thought that his onstage seizures were just part of the show. The depression and the anxiety of Ian Curtis's medical condition fed into his lyrical and vocal style, with his lyrics being filled with themes of isolation, depression, and desperation. With Joy Division having achieved pretty solid success in England and having toured Europe to good crowd responses, Joy Division scheduled a tour of America. But on the eve of their departure for that trip, Ian Curtis wound up committing suicide. The rest of the band decided to continue together, but to change the name in recognition that Ian Curtis was irreplaceable, and that the band's music would certainly change without his contributions. Guitar player Bernard Sumner took over the lead vocal spot, and the band recruited Jillian Gilbert, who was the girlfriend of the band's drummer Steve Morris, to become the new band's keyboard player and occasional second guitar player. Well, as I noted, Joy Division had started out as a punk band. The evolution of their sound wound up becoming the basis for the sort of brainy and experimental post-punk music that would directly feed into the alternative music boom of the 1980s and 90s. Joy Division's music was unusual because Bernard Sumner, as lead guitar player, played mostly rhythms and chords, while bass player Peter Hook played his bass guitar in a very lead guitar style, and the band's drummer Steve Morris had a style in which he would follow the rhythm of the guitars with his drum playing rather than just keeping a solid time for the band to follow. Existing Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees The Cure and U2 both have notably cited the music of Joy Division as an important influence on their own styles. And Soundgarden, who's another nominee for possible induction this year, also has cited Joy Division as a formative influence. I have heard some people try and claim that Joy Division might very well be considered the first goth band, but I'm not sure if I really take that argument. Neither one of Joy Division's two albums charted in the United States, but both of them wound up being top five albums in their native UK. Only five singles were released by the band during their short recording career. Joy Division's song, Love Will Tear Us Apart, was a moderate hit in the UK, and the double single, Atmosphere, which was backed with She's Lost Control, was a minor hit. And Love Will Tear Us Apart got a little bit of play in the US dance clubs of the time. After Ian Curtis's death, when the band changed to New Order, the first songs from New Order were songs that they had composed while Ian Curtis was still alive. And those songs sound very much like Joy Division, except for the obvious change on lead vocals. New Order wound up learning to control the mixing board in the studio during sessions for their first album, and from that point on, the band began producing their own music. The members of the band had already been fascinated and influenced by the sound of the German band Kraftwerk and by Can, and they also loved Brian Eno's solo music, as well as his production work on David Bowie's Berlin trilogy of albums in the 1970s. Those sorts of electronic music influences got more pronounced as the band experimented with their sound to move away from what they had been doing as Joy Division. When New Order visited America in 1981, they discovered the early hip-hop culture in New York City and also were taken by the sounds of the synth-funk music that was on the rise in America in the aftermath of disco becoming passé. The band at this time had also been listening to a lot of disco music out of Italy to help lighten their moods. Meanwhile, during this time, in the band's native Manchester, the Hacienda nightclub opened in 1982, and this nightclub would wind up being ground zero in England for the rise of rave dance culture. All of these musical elements helped to feed into New Order's move towards integrating more dance beats into their musical style, with the band's drummer Steve Morris teaching himself how to program beats on the drum machines of the time. In 1983, New Order released their second album, the hugely influential album Power, Corruption, and Lies. On the UK version of this album, New Order hadn't yet included the song Blue Monday. That song was out only as a single in England. But on the American version of Power, Corruption, and Lies, that song was included. And Blue Monday became one of the most influential and acclaimed dance music songs of all time. The influence of Blue Monday was so massive that Kraftwerk, one of the bands that helped to influence the direction of New Order, wound up itself being in turn influenced by the music of New Order. Kraftwerk took Blue Monday as a signpost to change their own musical directions. After the release of that influential second album, New Order went on to become one of the most influential, innovative, and popular dance music bands of the 1980s. The band continued recording and touring until 1993, and then finally took a 5-year hiatus. They came back for a while, but disbanded again, due in part to personal issues between Peter Hook and Bernard Sumner. Bernard Sumner would wind up reforming New Order in 2011, but did so without Peter Hook. And the band continues playing to this day, but the rift between Hook and Sumner has not been healed as of yet. New Order has released 10 full-length studio albums from 1981 through 2015, and they've also released 6 live albums, 5 EPs, and there are 12 compilation albums dedicated to the band's music. 2 of New Order's studio albums went to number 1 in the UK, and 6 more of their albums were top 10 albums there. In the USA, New Order's greatest success was with their 1993 album, Republic, which went to number 11 on the Billboard album charts here. And that album, along with their 1989 album, Technique, is one of 2 albums from the band that were able to achieve gold-level sales status here. The band's compilation album, Substance 1987, was eventually certified a platinum seller in the United States, although that album topped out at only number 36 on the Billboard album charts. 3 of New Order's compilation albums wound up also being top 10 albums in the UK. 27 of New Order's songs were top 40 hits in the UK, including a number 1 hit for their 1990 song, World in Motion. 7 other of the band's songs went into the UK top 10. In the USA, New Order only placed 2 songs in the pop top 40, with a number 32 hit for their 1987 song Truth Faith and a number 28 hit for their 1993 song Regret. New Order's greatest success in the United States has come on the dance club charts, where the band has placed 16 hits, including 5 number 1 dance songs and 7 more songs that hit the top 5 on the dance club charts. If we want to look at the normal Rock and Roll Hall of Fame criteria, as far as innovation, both Joy Division and New Order separately were both extremely innovative in different musical directions, with both of these bands delivering new sounds that made them stand out as unique and special bands. As far as the band's commercial impact, they had a huge impact in dance culture. But on the pop charts outside of the UK, their commercial impact was pretty minimal on mainstream culture. As far as influence, the band has been absolutely massive in both incarnations, with a huge number of alternative bands that consider Joy Division a key influence, and New Order helping to kick off the entire English rave scene. As far as the concept of musical excellence, without a question, this band is excellent and unique musicians, able to produce their own music, and always striving to excel. For my own personal thoughts, I personally wouldn't mind inducting each of these two bands on their own merits as separate entries. So with this nomination being a combination of the two, to me it's an absolute slam dunk obvious that they absolutely need to go in. As far as their chances of making it in, given the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's more populist tilt in recent years, I do have some concerns on whether or not these obviously important bands will wind up being snubbed, but I do still think they've got a pretty good shot, given the respect that other musical artists have for the band and their massive critical acclaim. As far as possible drama with this band, as I noted, there's a big personal rift between Bernard Sumner and Peter Hook that will certainly cause a certain amount of angst and drama over whether or not they can set aside those personal differences in order to play together at the Hall of Fame ceremonies. The members of New Order haven't actually done much to acknowledge their nomination, so there's actually a little bit of an open question as to whether they would appear at all. Peter Hook has embraced the nomination and absolutely intends to be there. So even if the other members don't make it, Peter Hook will be on hand in order to play some music. As far as who might do the induction speech, if Joy Division and New Order are inducted, there are a lot of choices. Electronic musician Moby is an avowed fan, and I could certainly see him doing an induction. Or Michael Stipe of REM, who has a deep affinity both for Ian Curtis's performing style as well as New Order's evolution into a more of a dance music style. Or I already mentioned that The Cure were influenced by Joy Division, so I could see Robert Smith of The Cure doing the induction speech, because he's a fan of both incarnations of this band. As far as songs, in this case, even though there's basically two bands' catalogs of music, if they only get three songs, I could see them attempting to cover the evolution of the band by playing a Joy Division song, most likely Love Will Tear Us Apart Again, since that was their most popular song, and then playing a song from New Order's first album, such as Ceremony, in which New Order is still sounding a lot like Joy Division, and then completing it with a New Order song, which, of course, absolutely must be Blue Monday. Let's listen to Blue Monday now. Enjoy! Next up on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nominations for this year is Iron Maiden. Iron Maiden has been eligible for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame since 1995, and this is their second time on the list of nominees. The members of the band that would be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame are Clive Burr, Paul Di'Anno, Bruce Dickinson, Janet Gers, Steve Harris, Nico McBrain, Dave Murray, Adrian Smith, and Dennis Stratton. There's a long list of musicians who have been members of Iron Maiden over the years who are not being included as part of their nomination. These include the band's original vocalist Paul Day, who never actually recorded with the band, Terry Rance and Dave Sullivan, who were the original guitar players, and Ron Rebel Matthews, who was the original drummer for the band, who also never actually recorded with them. The band's second singer was Dennis Wilcox, and he also left the band before their recording career. Bob Sawyer played guitar with the band briefly in 1977, and Terry Wapram was the band's sole guitar player for a little while and also left before they started recording. And Barry Thunderstick Perkis was the drummer for a couple of years before their recording career. Tony Moore was a keyboard player who played with the band for just a single show before they decided that adding a keyboard player at that time was a mistake. There's also Paul Todd, who was in the band for just 1 week until his girlfriend told him that she would leave him if he went on tour with the band, and so he wound up leaving. So all of those names are pretty obvious to be left off, since none of them actually ever recorded with the band. However, there are people that recorded with the band that are also being left off, including drummer Doug Sampson, who played on some of the band's early demos and radio appearances. Paul Cairns, who was a guitar player for 3 months, but did manage to appear on a couple of the band's early demos. And Tony Parsons, who spent 2 months with the band on guitar and wound up appearing on the BBC rock show with them in 1979. Once again, all those names are pretty minor footnotes in the history of the band. But probably the most controversial person to leave out is singer Blaze Bailey, who took over as singer for the band for 2 albums and for 2 world tours from 1994 to 1999. Blaze Bailey is not being inducted as part of the band. It should also be noted that Michael Kenney, although having never officially been listed as a band member, has worked for the band as a bass tech since 1980, and he has contributed keyboards to their live shows since 1988, and he appears on 4 studio albums and 12 of their live albums. So in my opinion, both Blaze Bailey and Michael Kenney most likely should have been included on the list of nominees. Iron Maiden is probably the biggest metal band in the world. They play to massive stadium-sized audiences in all corners of the globe. The band's albums have charted at number 1 in many countries worldwide, although they've never actually had a number 1 album in the USA. The music of Iron Maiden fuses the dark and heavy riffing of Black Sabbath and infuses it with the melodicism of 70s prog rock. The band adopted much of the fashion sense and the operatic lead vocal styles that Judas Priest had introduced as the foundations of metal music. And the two bands wound up forming something of a rivalry. Iron Maiden spent time opening shows for Priest, but they eventually went on to greatly surpass Priest's popularity, which has led to much of that rivalry. The classic Iron Maiden formula features a triple guitar lineup, with each player bringing a little bit of a different style, which makes for a complex harmonic interplay and multidimensional possibility for their song arrangements. Iron Maiden's bass player uses a unique rhythmic playing style that gives their music much of its fast-paced driving force. I already noted their operatic lead vocal style, which for most of the band's career was supplied by Bruce Dickinson. Dickinson regularly won fan polls among metal fans for being the best metal vocalist of all time. Dickinson was not the band's original vocalist. The band's first 2 albums featured vocalist Paul Di'Anno, who was a much more raspy punk-style vocalist. And as I mentioned, Di'Anno is among the nominees for the Hall of Fame with this band. After Bruce Dickinson took over, he continued with the band until 1993, at which point he left for a time and was replaced in the band with Blaze Bailey. The 2 albums with Blaze Bailey on vocals are widely considered by their fans to be the 2 worst albums of the band's career, and that perhaps is why Bailey is not being included among the members of the band in their nomination. As I noted, in the United States, Iron Maiden has never achieved a number 1 album, but they have achieved 4 platinum-level sales albums and 3 gold-level albums here. Meanwhile, 5 of Iron Maiden's albums went to number 1 in the UK, and they've also charted number 1 albums in Austria, in Canada, Finland, Germany, Italy, New Zealand, Norway, Sweden, and also in Switzerland. In Australia, 2 of their albums reached as high as number 2 on the Australian charts, and in Japan, their best chart position was at number 5. For singles, the band has never had any pop success in the USA, but 4 of their songs did appear on the rock radio charts. In the band's native UK, they have charted 34 songs on the top 40 charts, including having 1 number 1 single. They also do well in Finland, where they've had 6 number 1 songs on the Finnish song charts, and in Sweden, where they've had 1 number 1 song. The band's also had singles chart appearances in Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, and Switzerland. Because of that multinational level of success, Iron Maiden has quite commonly gone out on true world tours, playing to huge crowds on every continent except for Antarctica. The band to date has played well over 2,000 shows around the world. Their shows are renowned for their live prowess, displaying spectacular playing technique, and putting on display dazzling stage designs that they regularly update, all centering around the band's iconic ghoulish mascot, Eddie. Eddie may just be the most recognizable and popular band mascot of all time. And really, if I had one real criticism to make about the band's nomination, it would be that it seems to me like Eddie should actually probably be included along with the band members for induction into the Hall of Fame. It's well noted that the Rock Hall has been very resistant to most heavy rock and metal bands. Historically, this is evidenced by the fact that it took Black Sabbath 8 times being nominated before they were finally inducted, and by the voters' complete disinterest in inducting Judas Priest, who eventually had to go in last year under the musical excellence category. However, there are cases for bands that are simply too massively successful to be ignored that the Hall has come through. After years of the process snubbing Kiss for nomination, when Kiss finally got nominated, they were voted right in. Metallica got in on their very first try, and Guns N' Roses as well were nominated and inducted into the Hall of Fame on their very first year of eligibility. To me, Iron Maiden seems like one of the bands that simply are too massive to ignore, but they aren't quite as big in the United States as they are worldwide, and Iron Maiden was snubbed the first time that they were nominated. While all heavy metal bands have a certain amount of controversy around them, there's really not as much historical controversy around Iron Maiden as there is around, say, Judas Priest. Although when Iron Maiden released their album, The Number of the Beast, there were certainly a number of church groups calling for the album to be destroyed. But Iron Maiden has never really been one of those metal bands that went overboard in embracing satanic influences. In fact, Iron Maiden has not only publicly disavowed Satanism, their drummer is actually a born-again Christian. The Number of the Beast album is named after a song on the album that was inspired by the nightmares their bass player had after watching one of the Omen sequels one night. If Iron Maiden is inducted, it seems quite likely that the band as a whole would not show up. Several members of the band have made complete indifference and disregard for the Hall of Fame very public. Indeed, the band has forbidden reporters from even asking the band about their nomination. And it should be noted that the Hall of Fame performance format isn't really designed around Iron Maiden being able to put on the type of show that would meet their typical standards. There's always the chance that a few members of the band might show up to accept the award, but likely not enough of them to put on a performance of the band's songs. Perhaps any members that did show up could form some sort of pickup band made up of members of bands that Iron Maiden has inspired, but it most likely would wind up being a sad reflection on what their music really does sound like. And really, who could blame this band for not bothering to show up? At this point, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame needs Iron Maiden as a member in order to stay relevant, much more than Iron Maiden needs the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame to establish any sort of long-term legacy for itself. Iron Maiden has released 17 studio albums, 13 live albums, and they have 7 compilation albums dedicated to their music. The band's best chart performer in the United States was their most recent album in 2021, which ranked at number 3 for 1 week. In reviewing the typical criteria for Hall of Fame membership, if we look at innovation, musically, Iron Maiden's music started out as fairly derivative of the innovations that were made by Black Sabbath and by Judas Priest. But Iron Maiden wound up cranking everything up to prodigy-level technical playing. The band's shows are legendary for their pyrotechnics and energy, and Iron Maiden is also well known for their very well thought out and expansive merchandising. So on the business side of things, the band has definitely had a number of innovations. As far as musical influence, other than Black Sabbath, Iron Maiden may very well be the most influential metal band in history if you simply look at the number of bands that started out their careers as fans of their music. As far as musical excellence, Iron Maiden is well known for their technical skill and their absolutely relentless live shows. As far as my own personal thoughts, I think Iron Maiden obviously must go into the Hall of Fame. I'm not personally a huge fan. I don't listen to a lot of Iron Maiden, but I absolutely recognize their legendary status. As far as their chances of making it in, I think it's kind of 50-50 this year. There's not a ton of guitar rock on this year's list of nominees, although there is a risk of them splitting votes a bit with Rage Against the Machine, with any voters that are going to vote for just a single hard rock band. And there certainly are still a lot of voters that won't vote for any controversial or really extreme music. As far as drama goes, Iron Maiden has amongst the highest likelihoods of drama with the Hall of Fame. At this point, with the many disparaging comments that the band has made about the Rock Hall, it would actually be downright shocking if they wound up showing up. The question then would be if the Rock Hall would wind up having anybody play a tribute to them in their absence. And based on recent history, I would kind of think that this was not likely. As far as people that might induct them, Scott Ian of Anthrax would be a good choice, or Lars Ulrich of Metallica. Paul Stanley of Kiss might also be willing to do so as well. On the off chance that there was some kind of a performance, as far as songs that might be played, Run to the Hills, of course, is a must. The Number of the Beast would also make sense. And so the real question would be the third choice, and I'm leaning towards their song The Trooper as being the most likely here. Let's go ahead and listen to Run to the Hills now. Enjoy! Our next nominee for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is Kate Bush. Kate Bush has been eligible for the Rock Hall since 2004. This is her fourth time on a nomination ballot, with her first time being in 2018, and then she's had three consecutive nominations in 2021, 22, and this year. It's generally hard for Americans to truly understand just how culturally significant Kate Bush is in England. Here in America, she's always been a pretty niche figure, known for one minor solo hit, Running Up That Hill, and also for her one collaborative song with Peter Gabriel, Don't Give Up, and perhaps a bit as well for the regular MTV play of her non-hit song, Hounds of Love. Meanwhile, in the UK, Kate Bush is celebrated as one of their most significant musical and artistic institutions, where her status in their culture is underlined by the fact that Running Up That Hill was highlighted during a segment of the 2012 London Olympic opening ceremonies. Olympic ceremonies are generally designed to display to the world the key important art, music, and culture of each host country. And Kate Bush's music was chosen to be one of those highlighted segments at those London Games, because her music there is important enough to be considered a definitive part of what it means to be British. Every album Kate Bush has released in her career has been a major success in her home country. Her worst charting album of her entire career in England went to number 6 on the UK charts. If the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame were an English institution instead of an American one, Kate Bush would have certainly been a first ballot Hall of Famer back in 2004. Kate Bush is a true artist with absolute control over every aspect of her image, her music, and her performances. She personally consults with the fashion designers on her desired looks. She writes all her own music, and she has self-produced her own music since fairly early in her career. In the rare instances when she still does perform live, note that Kate Bush has not done a major tour since 1979, but she has performed for charity benefits and done occasional residencies in specific venues. In those rare occasions when she has performed, she hand-selects her crew down to the most menial tasks, and she's integral in designing all of the choreography and the stage sets and even the lighting cues for her performances. She's even gotten involved in the audio-technical aspects of performance, having worked early in her career with Sonic Engineers to create one of the very first headset microphones in order to free her hands to perform her choreography that I previously mentioned. There are certainly several reasons that can be noted as to why Bush's success in America has been so limited. There is definitely a quintessential Englishness to her music that doesn't necessarily translate here, except perhaps to true Anglophiles. And certainly, Kate Bush's refusal to tour has kept her from one of the key promotional tools that often help musicians gain more fans here in America. Her music also simply doesn't fit conveniently into the narrow genre-focused playlists of American radio. Kate Bush's music is essentially a genre unto itself. At her roots, Kate Bush is a child of the glam era of British music, and you can hear some influences in her music from David Bowie and Roxy Music, especially on her early records. And her music is also influenced by English prog and certainly by folk rock. But she also fused those influences with traditional Celtic and Baroque elements and a lot of English musical theater. As her career has progressed, Kate Bush has added more influences from various world music sources and also added a lot of modern electronica as well. If you look at today's modern musical landscape, I think Kate Bush is one of the most influential artists on this year's list of very notable nominees. There is a long list of modern female singers with eclectic and ethereal musical styles that would all seem to be direct descendants of Kate Bush's influence. I think Kate Bush absolutely should be in the Hall of Fame. And that opinion is in spite of the fact that I don't personally enjoy listening to her very much. For my ears, I do not particularly enjoy the sound of her weird, high-pitched pixie vocals that she often employs, nor the constant melodrama of her songs. But I do respect her for her originality and for her artistic vision, even though I don't particularly mesh with the resulting art that she makes from that. As noted, Kate Bush never became a major mainstream star in America. Running Up That Hill, when it was first released, went to only number 30 and was her biggest pop hit here. And then last year, that song took on new life when it was highlighted on the American horror show Stranger Things. That show introduced the song to a new audience, and the song re-entered the charts and ultimately topped out at number 3. So, as of last year, Kate Bush is still a one-hit wonder in America, but it's now a major hit instead of a minor hit. The song Don't Give Up with Peter Gabriel, as I mentioned, got heavy MTV airplay, but it didn't get a lot of radio play. Kate Bush's 1985 album Hounds of Love went to number 30 on the Billboard charts here, and her 1989 album The Sensual World did gain gold sales status in America. Meanwhile, in Britain, of her 10 studio albums, 9 were top 5, and I mentioned the other one was a number 6. And Kate Bush charted 25 singles on the British Top 40. Kate Bush became an immediate sensation in the UK from the release of her very first single, Wuthering Heights, which spent 4 weeks at number 1 on the British pop charts. After the success of her debut album in the UK, Kate Bush felt pressured to release a second album that she felt wound up being rushed out before she was truly satisfied with it. Therefore, Kate Bush used the power that she'd gained with her success to take over strong control over her career. At that point, she began self-producing her albums in order to control every single aspect of the musical direction, and she eventually built her own studio at which she could work at her own pace. Kate Bush was always a fiercely original artist who fused genre-bending music with a very inventive visual style and performance art style. Kate Bush has written all of her own songs since the very beginning of her career, with her songwriting style incorporating literary influences, with a lot of goth leanings, unblinking social commentary, and increasingly personal lyrics as her career evolved. Notable artists that are obvious descendants from Kate Bush would include Tori Amos, Annie Lennox, both in her solo career as well as in her time with the Eurythmics, Florence and the Machine, Bjork, and St. Vincent as well. Coldplay's lead singer, Chris Martin, is also an avowed fan of Kate Bush, as is Big Boy of the rap band Outkast. So as I mentioned, Kate Bush released 10 studio albums from 1978 through 2011. She also has released 2 live albums, and there are 3 compilation albums dedicated to her work, along with 5 EPs and 3 box sets. As far as looking at the typical Rock and Roll Hall of Fame criteria, as far as innovation, Kate Bush may be the most innovative musician on the entire list this year, due to her complex musical arrangements and genre-blending style, her innovative stage performances, her visionary music videos, and her pioneering work in creating the new headgear microphone setup. As far as commercial impact, in England, she is one of the most popular and beloved artists of her entire generation. But beyond England, she's definitely much more niche. As far as influence, it's almost impossible to overstate just how influential Bush's career was to following generations of female performers. As far as my personal thoughts on Kate Bush, as I said, I don't really particularly enjoy listening to her music, but I recognize how massively influential that she was. As far as her chances to make it in, I think obviously this year, with the huge publicity that she gained by the resurgence of Running Up That Hill as a major hit again, gives her her best chance to get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. If she doesn't go in this year, it's never going to happen through the normal voters. Her only path into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame will wind up being via the musical excellence category. As far as drama goes, Kate Bush has become pretty much of a hermit. She's fairly well retired from performing or really doing any public appearances in general. It would be downright shocking if she were to actually fly to America for this honor, and even more shocking if she were to actually perform, given how seldom she has performed during her career. I could see her doing something like Tina Turner did last year and simply filming a thank you video of acceptance for the honor, and then having the Rock Hall do a tribute performance to her by some of her many devotees. As far as who might induct Kate Bush if she does get inducted, I'd say Florence of Florence and the Machine would be obvious, or Tori Amos would also be a great choice. But also, Big Boy of Outkast would certainly love to do it. And also, of course, Peter Gabriel would certainly be able to be persuaded to do it. As far as songs that might be played, of course, Running Up That Hill would have to be done, absolutely. And if Peter Gabriel was on hand, you could certainly have a duet with Peter Gabriel and a female performer on Don't Give Up. If Peter Gabriel wasn't around, you could perhaps do Wuthering Heights, and maybe Pat Benatar could come back to the Hall of Fame to perform her version of that song. And then as far as another song, I'd say This Woman's Work would certainly be a good, apt choice. For our musical selection for Kate Bush, let's listen to Hounds of Love. Enjoy! The next nominee for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year is Cyndi Lauper. Cyndi Lauper has been eligible for nomination since 2009, and this is her first time on the ballot. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has obviously moved seriously into the MTV era, which is really no surprise, given that the Hall is now being run by a former MTV executive. Given that, Cyndi Lauper is no surprise at all to finally be getting a nomination for the Hall. She is one of the icons of the MTV generation, known as much for her outrageous fashion sense as she is for her big hit songs. When Cyndi Lauper debuted in 1983, it was the same year that Madonna also made her debut. And part of what's been forgotten to history is that initially, Cyndi Lauper was the much more consequential artist than Madonna based on their debuts. Although after that, Madonna has certainly gone on to have the much more consequential career. Cyndi Lauper's debut album, She's So Unusual, produced 4 top 5 hits, which was the first time that a debut from a woman had ever achieved that level of success. Those hits were Girls Just Wanna Have Fun, She Bop, Time After Time, and All Through the Night. Lauper wound up being awarded the Best New Artist Grammy that year due to her meteoric rise to fame. Lauper would wind up continuing her pop success with hit songs from the Goonies soundtrack and with her sophomore album True Colors, which also contained 2 more top 5 hits for her. From that start, Cyndi Lauper has gone on to have a diverse career, exploring a variety of musical genres and working on Broadway, including being awarded a Tony Award for her original score for the Broadway play Kinky Boots. This made Cyndi Lauper the first woman to ever win a Tony Award as the sole composer for a musical. The play Kinky Boots won 5 additional Tony Awards that year as well. Lauper has also won an Emmy Award, which puts her just an Oscar short of an EGOT status. She was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and she has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Cyndi Lauper was born in Brooklyn, New York, and grew up in Queens. She began playing guitar and writing songs at the age of 12, and she developed her eclectic visual presentation at a young age. Cyndi Lauper spent the 1970s in a variety of cover bands, trying her hand at disco, at hard rock, blues, and at pop music. Her 4-octave singing range gave her an ability to sing diverse genres of music, but she wound up damaging her vocal cords, and at one point, she was told her singing career was over. But she was eventually able to recover from that, and while her vocal range remained large, the vocal cord damage that she had suffered did give her voice a bit more of an added gravelly character. In 1978, Lauper formed a band dedicated to original music, which she called Blue Angel, and Blue Angel wound up recording a debut album in 1980. This album was critically acclaimed, but a complete commercial flop, so the band wound up breaking up, and her manager sued her. Cyndi Lauper wound up working retail jobs and at restaurants while going back to singing solo in local clubs. For her solo debut album, She's So Unusual, Lauper wrote 4 of the songs herself, including the hit songs Time After Time and She Bop. And on the songs that she covered, she freely changed lyrics to the songs that she didn't write in order to suit her own persona and her own philosophical outlooks. She's So Unusual wound up containing 5 very smartly selected covers. And Cyndi Lauper was able to completely reinvent each of these songs into her own image. She's one of the few artists to do a cover of a Prince song that he actually liked with her version of When You Were Mine. The album She's So Unusual wound up spending 65 weeks in the Billboard charts and sold over 16 million copies worldwide. Her sophomore album, True Colors, was a number 4 album. Cyndi Lauper's conquest of the pop charts and her originality of style wound up being a big influence on modern pop stars like Katy Perry and Lady Gaga, and it helped to move punk rock fashion into mainstream pop. Over her career, Cyndi Lauper has released 11 albums as a solo artist, in addition to her debut group album with Blue Angel, and is also credited for her Broadway cast album for the musical Kinky Boots. There are 14 compilation albums that collect Cyndi Lauper's music, and she has released 3 EPs. It should be noted that Cyndi Lauper's commercial impact is pretty well relegated to her first 2 solo albums, so there is a bit of a thinness to her overall catalog. Though her overall success is broader than that of the Go-Go's who went in recently, and it's miles beyond the amount of commercial success that the Zombies had, who were put into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame several years ago. Cyndi Lauper has 10 top 40 hits, including 2 number 1 hits, and she also wound up appearing on the number 1 charity hit, We Are the World. 5 more of her hits were in the top 5, and 1 was in the top 10. So of her 10 top 40 hits, 8 were top 10s. Looking at the typical Rock and Roll Hall of Fame criteria, as far as innovation goes, Cyndi Lauper was excellent at developing a very personal sound and reinventing songs into her own image, but it's really her visual presentation that was more innovative, really, than her music was. As far as commercial impact, she was hugely successful at her start, as I mentioned, and she's had an impressive range of success in the entertainment industry, in movies and on Broadway, and even doing performances as part of professional wrestling. But musically speaking, she was a little bit of a flash in the pan as a pop star. As far as influence goes, Cyndi Lauper's image and persona have made her a big influence on later generations of female performers. She gave them permission to just be themselves. As far as musical excellence goes, Cyndi Lauper was an outstanding technical singer with an impressive range and a great ear for rearranging songs in different styles. For my own personal thoughts, I think Cyndi Lauper is an absolute icon of her generation, but I don't think there's been any major snub in having made her wait this long at this point, and I have no problem if it takes her a few nominations to get in, because as I said, her overall resume doesn't really put her quite at the level of top-tier artists in the Hall of Fame. But she definitely has a better resume than a good number of existing Hall of Fame members, and I do think that she deserves to go in the Hall of Fame eventually. I just don't necessarily think it has to be this year. As far as her chances of getting in, they're pretty good. She's been competing hard for first place in the fan vote with George Michael. I do, however, think that since it took Pat Benatar more than one try to get into the Hall of Fame, Cyndi Lauper may need more than one chance as well. Although I think she has less competition on this ballot than Pat Benatar did when she was nominated. As far as any potential drama, I don't really see any. I would absolutely be shocked if Cyndi Lauper didn't embrace this award and didn't show up, and if she did not perform. As far as somebody that might induct Cyndi Lauper, I think Pink might be a very good choice. Or maybe Katy Perry or Lady Gaga. Or, if you want to have a little bit of fun, how about her close friend from wrestling, Hulk Hogan? As far as the songs that might be played if Cyndi is inducted, Girls Just Want to Have Fun is an absolute must. True Colors and Time After Time also seem like very likely choices. Let's go ahead and listen to her classic hit, Girls Just Want to Have Fun, now. Enjoy! Our next nominee for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is George Michael. George Michael's been eligible for the Hall of Fame since 2010, and this is his first time on a ballot. I'll say straight up, I absolutely hated Wham from the moment that I first heard them. Their songs made my teeth grind. So when George Michael went solo, I fully wished him nothing but failure and a quick descent into obscurity. But then George Michael wound up releasing his album Faith, and while it wasn't music I intentionally would ever play, I had to admit it was solidly constructed and catchy pop music. And later, as his career developed, I wound up learning that George Michael fully wrote all of his songs himself, music and lyrics, and he self-produced all of his own singles and albums as well, which becomes even more impressive when you listen to the heavy orchestration and sophisticated arrangements that George Michael liked to package his songs in. So over time, I grudgingly learned to respect the man as a true artist, just one that happened to produce some musical art that wasn't often in line with my own musical tastes. George Michael was born in Middlesex, England, and he developed an interest in music at the age of 8. As a teenager, he worked as a DJ, and he did street busking, and he played occasionally in local clubs, and he formed a ska band. George Michael formed Wham at the age of 18 with school friend Andrew Ridgely in 1981, and the two of them released two albums, both of which went to number one in the UK. The first album didn't do well in America, but the group's second album was a huge hit in America as well. In 1985, Wham became the first Western pop act to tour in China. During his time with Wham, George Michael released his first solo single, which was Careless Whisper, which was one of the songs that George Michael had written himself. This song went to number one in 20 different countries, at the same time that Wham itself was having huge hits, such as Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go and Last Christmas. The song Last Christmas would eventually wind up having an entire movie storyline built around the lyrics of the song. Wham would wind up breaking up in 1986, and the duo exited with a sold-out concert at Wembley Stadium. George Michael's solo debut album, Faith, was released and wound up spending 12 weeks at number one on the American Billboard charts and wound up selling over 25 million copies worldwide. Four songs off of the album went to number one on the pop charts in America. George Michael was the worldwide number one best-selling artist of 1988, and he won Album of the Year at the Grammy Awards for Faith in 1989. The song I Want Your Sex, which was the first single off of Faith, wound up causing controversy, and it was censored, including Casey Kasem of the American Top 40 radio program refusing to even say the title of the song during his show, and instead just mentioning the song's placement on the chart with the latest single from George Michael. Despite this kind of censorship, the song still soared to number two on the pop charts. The follow-up single from Faith became the first song from the album to go to number one, and that was the album's title cut, Faith. This song wound up becoming the overall number one single of 1988 in America. The songs Father Figure, One More Try, and Monkey all followed and all went to number one on the pop charts as well. Despite the massive success of his debut album, George Michael wound up feeling dissatisfied. He found himself wanting to be taken more seriously as an artist rather than embracing his image as a teen pop star. George Michael wound up following up Faith in 1990 with his album Listen Without Prejudice, Volume 1, on which he took an effort to be taken more seriously as a songwriter. This album wound up going to number 2 on the Billboard charts, despite the fact that George Michael refused to do any promotional work for the album, wanting the music to speak for itself. The first single from the album, Praying for Time, was a social commentary song. And despite Michael refusing to do any promotion work, and even refusing to even appear in the music video that the record company made for the song, this song went to number one. The next single from the album, Freedom 90, was a reflection on George Michael's artistic identity, and this song went to number 8. After that, it wouldn't be until 2006 that George Michael released his third solo album, titled Older, and this album went to number 6 on the Billboard charts. George Michael would continue to record and perform on his own terms, often feuding with his record labels, in order to maintain his artistic freedom. He wound up releasing 5 solo albums between 1987 and 2004, along with his prior 2 albums that he'd made with Wham. 2 of George Michael's solo albums went platinum in the United States, and the other one gained the rarefied diamond sales status. In the UK, 4 of his 5 albums went to number 1, with the 5th album going to number 2. There have been 2 compilation albums made from George Michael's music, and 1 live album, as well as a live EP. 17 singles released by George Michael as a solo artist were hits on the American Top 40, with 15 of those 17 songs being top 10 songs, 10 of those being top 5 songs, and a remarkable 8 of them being number 1 songs. On the UK charts, George Michael placed 36 hit songs, with 7 of those being number ones, along with 5 of them at number 2 and 1 number 3 amongst those hits. Looking at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame typical criteria, as far as innovation goes, I personally don't think that George Michael was necessarily musically innovative so much as he was ambitious and meticulous with his music. As far as influence goes, he absolutely was one of the icons of his generation, although he very much rebelled against his celebrity status. In the category of musical excellence, despite the fact that I don't like really listening to much of his music, I think this is probably George Michael's greatest strength. He self-produced all of his own music, as I noted, and he endlessly fussed over every aspect, spending time to polish each song into a major hit. He had an obvious ear for what pop audiences wanted to hear, and was extremely adept at capturing that. Anybody that thinks that this is easy doesn't understand just how much work pop craft actually takes. If it was easy, everybody would have the kind of career that George Michael wound up having, instead of him being so much more massively successful than most of his contemporaries. As far as my own personal thoughts, as I noted, I was never a fan of his music. But the more I came to understand his life, career, and his art, the more I've come to respect George Michael as an artist. He may have been making art that I largely don't want to listen to, but I do have an admiration for the hard work of pure pop craft. As I said, making hit songs is damn hard, but George Michael was able to churn them out one after another, even when he stopped playing the industry games in order to promote his music, in order to get it to sell even better than it already was selling. As far as George Michael's chances of making it into the Hall of Fame now that he is on the ballot, I think they're good, but I don't think he's a shoe-in at all. George Michael's style is going to be a bit too pop for a certain segment of the voters, the sort of voters that took several tries in order to be convinced to let Janet Jackson be inducted into the Hall of Fame. George Michael's image as a teen idol can be a bit of an anchor with those type of voters. He has been competing strongly for the fan vote, although it looks like ultimately he'll wind up in second place a little bit behind Cyndi Lauper. As far as any potential drama, since George Michael has passed away, there's no drama to be worried about over whether or not he would show up to accept the award. The question will be what the Hall of Fame does to pay tribute to him in his absence. As far as who might induct them, Elton John seems absolutely to be the obvious choice here. The two of them were close, and really, if George Michael had been less uncomfortable with his pop stardom, he very well might have wound up with the type of career that could truly rival Elton John as far as the total number of huge hits. As far as songs that might be played in his honor, the song Faith for sure seems like an obvious one. And I'm thinking Freedom 90 makes sense as well, and perhaps Praying for Time, although Careless Whisper and Father Figure certainly would be in the running as well. Let's go ahead and listen to Freedom 90 now. Enjoy! The next nominee for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year is Soundgarden. Soundgarden has been eligible for nomination since 2012, and this is the second time that they've been on the ballot, with their first nomination coming in 2020. Members of the band to be inducted include Matt Cameron, Chris Cornell, Ben Shepherd, Kim Thayil, and Hiro Yamamoto. Not being inducted with the band would be Scott Sundquist, who was the original drummer for the band, but never actually recorded with them. Also not being inducted is Jason Everman, who wound up filling in on bass for the band after Hiro Yamamoto had left the band and before Ben Shepherd joined them. It's been a bit odd to me how long Soundgarden had to wait for their first nomination for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and then that they had to wait a few years for their second nomination when they didn't get in the first time they were nominated. Pearl Jam and Nirvana were both nominated in their very first years of eligibility, and both of those bands immediately were inducted into the Hall of Fame. And while certainly Pearl Jam and Nirvana both wound up being more commercially successful than Soundgarden, both of those bands were heavily indebted to and influenced by Soundgarden's pioneering work in the Seattle grunge music scene. In Seattle, grunge music had been built out of a fusion of the big dark sound of early 70s Black Sabbath, mixed with the lo-fi West Coast hardcore punk rock style of the 1980s, and then also infused with the more thoughtful and experimental post-punk music of the UK of the 1980s. Sprinkle all of those bass influences with a mix of other influences for each of the bands in the Seattle scene in order to differentiate themselves from each other, and you wound up having a healthy and thriving music scene in the Northwest, with all of the area bands pushing each other onward in a healthy sense of competition and mutual support. With Soundgarden, among those other influences that you can hear within their music are Led Zeppelin, along with the goth band Bauhaus, and also Butthole Surfers. Formed in 1984, Soundgarden are among the original architects of the grunge sound, along with other bands like the Melvins and Green River. Soundgarden was one of the early bands to sign on to the new Sub Pop label, and both the band and the label were able to mutually help the other to grow into success. Later on, Soundgarden would become the first band out of the grunge scene to sign with a major label, an act that was considered a bit controversial in the scene at the time, because that scene prided itself on its anti-corporate authenticity. But Soundgarden had been frustrated with the lack of distribution and the general organizational incompetence of the indie labels that they had been working with to that time. And they shockingly decided that they actually wanted to be able to afford to eat. When Nirvana exploded out of the grunge scene to become a major phenomenon, it suddenly brought worldwide focus to the Seattle music scene, and labels began rushing in to sign anybody they could find. However, in the case of Soundgarden, they already had their major label deal in hand, and so they were one of the first bands to be able to quickly take advantage of this new exposure. The band's third album, Bad Motorfinger, came out just 1 month after Nirvana's Nevermind album. And while Bad Motorfinger didn't produce any big hits, the song Outshined did get some decent airplay, and the album wound up going on to sell 2 million copies. 2 years later, the band released their album Super Unknown, which debuted at number one on the album charts, and wound up producing 5 hits on the alternative rock radio charts, including the song Black Hole Sun, which would be the first of 6 number ones that Soundgarden would wind up scoring on the mainstream rock radio charts. Soundgarden released one more album in 1996, and this album would again be another platinum album for the band, and it also produced a number of hits on the alternative rock and mainstream rock charts. But the band would wind up breaking up the following year, with tensions in the band caused by road fatigue and disagreements over their musical direction. The band would later reform in 2010 and finally record a 6th studio album in 2012. And this album brought the band back to the mainstream rock charts again with 2 more number one mainstream rock songs. Chris Cornell unfortunately committed suicide in 2017, right at the start of a planned new major tour by the band. When you look back at the Seattle grunge scene, Soundgarden's music sort of shines through as the most sophisticated and technically accomplished of the entire scene. While the band was instrumental in helping to construct the grunge sound at its start, they continued to experiment widely away from many of the grunge stereotypes. Chris Cornell was an absolutely phenomenal singer, and Kim Thayil was an inventive and interesting guitar player. I personally think Soundgarden is critical to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in order to properly discuss 90s music history. There's no doubt that Soundgarden fits the definition of musical excellence, and their influence and legacy as a founding force in grunge is plain for anybody to see that really looks into the history of that music. Soundgarden doesn't have the sort of sales accomplishments of Nirvana or Pearl Jam, and the fact that Soundgarden broke up at their height of fame and stayed apart for well over 10 years means that they wound up losing a lot of popular momentum in their career that could have added to their overall legacy and the depth of their overall catalog. So due to those issues, I'm a little unsure if they'll go into the Hall of Fame any easier this second nomination after failing to be voted in their first time. Soundgarden's catalog includes 6 studio albums from 1988 to 2012, including achieving a number one album in 1994 with Super Unknown, and a number two album in 1996 with Down on the Upside, and a number five ranking for their 2012 comeback album, King Animal. The band had 1 platinum album, 1 double platinum album, and 1 album that went 6 times platinum. The band also released 2 live albums, and there's been 6 compilation albums dedicated to their music, along with 7 EPs. While the band was successful on rock radio and alternative radio, they had no pop crossover hit success. Black Rain got to number 96 in 2010, and that was their closest thing to a pop hit. 12 of their songs were hits on the alternative charts, and 13 of their songs were hits on the rock radio charts, including 6 number one songs on that rock radio chart. As far as the Rock Hall criteria, as far as innovation goes, Soundgarden were a pioneer of grunge music. They were definitely one of the early innovators of that style and should be recognized for that innovation. And then as their career went on, they expanded well beyond that sound and were not held back by it, continuing to tinker with their music throughout their career. As far as commercial impact, there's no doubt Soundgarden became a huge band. In many ways, they rivaled Nirvana and Pearl Jam as the kings of grunge, although Nirvana and Pearl Jam did wind up having even more massive commercial success. As far as influence goes, as I noted, Nirvana and Pearl Jam were themselves influenced by Soundgarden in their approach to music. And there are a lot of current bands in the alternative metal genre that still cite Soundgarden as an influence. As far as musical excellence, as I noted, Chris Cornell had among the best voices of his entire generation, and Soundgarden was known for its technical expertise and their incorporation of odd and difficult time signatures in their music. As far as my own other personal thoughts, I'm still a bit baffled why Soundgarden has seemed to take such a back seat as the Hall has begun to embrace 90s music. I think they absolutely need to be in the Hall of Fame. As far as their chances to make it in, like I said, they were passed over once already, which means it could absolutely happen again, although I hope it doesn't. And it's been way too long since Chris Cornell's unfortunate suicide in order for the band to depend on any sympathy votes at this point. I wouldn't necessarily say the band is a long shot by any stretch, but I also don't think they're one of the odds-on favorites out of this current ballot. As far as any potential drama, there are certainly questions as to who would do the lead vocals if the band was to perform. And there's also, of course, open questions about whether or not Hiro Yamamoto would be willing to reunite and play with the band, and or if the band would be open to allowing him to do that. So this is definitely one of those bands where there is potential drama involved with the Hall of Fame performance. As far as who might induct the band, I would think Eddie Vedder would be a very likely choice, given his friendship with Chris Cornell. As far as the songs that might be played if the band is inducted, I'd say the most likely three would be Black Hole Sun, Spoon Man, and Outshine. Let's listen to Black Hole Sun now. This song is going to conclude this week's episode. I thank you for listening. Please tune in next week when I will conclude my comments on this year's nominees for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame by discussing the resumes of the final five nominees that I have not yet discussed. As always, if you have any questions, complaints, criticisms, or just want to say hi, send an email to tony@roadtojamnation.com, or you can join my public Facebook group, also called Road to Jam Nation, and leave any comments you have there. I hope you've been enjoying this. I hope you'll be back next week. Now let's listen to Black Hole Sun by Soundgarden. Enjoy!